Good morning, everybody. Is this microphone? Oh, now it's on. Welcome to our November 29th work session on inclusionary housing. And I will kick things off here, and then we'll invite up several invited guests to talk to us about the policy. Inclusionary housing policies are an important tool to help ensure economically integrated neighborhoods across our city. It's a policy that can give working Portlanders the possibility of living in the neighborhood they work. It can give children the possibility of living in a mixed-income building and an economically diverse neighborhood, which research has shown time and time again can improve their educational attainment and future. Fundamentally, inclusionary housing is about opportunity and equity. This council recognized that when we unanimously chose to make this our top legislative priority to repeal the ban on inclusionary zoning in the 2016 legislative session. We worked with advocates, community organizations, and developers to make that happen. During the process, we promised state legislators that we'd engage in a data-driven, inclusive process to develop an inclusionary housing policy in Portland, and that we wouldn't rest on our laurels. And we haven't. In the months that have passed since the repeal of the ban, we worked to put together a top-notch group of advisors, we call them our panel of experts, to provide input and data to put together the package of recommendations that are being discussed today. We also secured a nationally recognized team to provide us with a market economic analysis to carefully calibrate this policy. Today, we'll learn more about that policy from Kurt Krieger and Matt Schibold of the Portland Housing Bureau, and we will hear from members of the panel of experts and members of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, which also voted in favor of this policy. And before we turn it over to Kurt and Matt, I'd like to introduce David Rosen and Nora Lake Brown of David Rosen and Associates, who conducted our market economic analysis. David Rosen Associates, or DRA, is widely recognized as one of the leading economic, legal, policy, and program experts in inclusionary zoning. DRA has advised more than 60 jurisdictions over the last 25 years on inclusionary housing and affordable housing linkage fees. DRA's focus practices on transactional advisory services and residential development, and DRA principals have advised on more than $9 billion of development, finance, and portfolios for affordable housing projects. And importantly, DRA's economic analysis and models for both inclusionary housing and housing linkage fee programs have been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. So, David and Nora, would you like to come on up and kick things off? And Kurt and Matt will come up too. Great. Welcome, and just housekeeping, if you can hit the button at the base of your microphone when you're speaking, and then...
Thank you, first of all, for the chance to serve the City of Portland on this important issue. It's our distinct pleasure to have been selected and to have the opportunity to work with a top-notch staff and a wonderful group of stakeholders and experts who devoted on a volunteer basis a significant amount of time and input in the process. In my opening remarks, I thought I'd give you a little bit of historical context, both for the subject of inclusionary housing nationally, as well as DRA's wide-ranging practice, and then ask Nora to focus her remarks on key findings and trends resulting from our analysis here in Portland. Inclusionary housing dates back 40 years to the Mount Laurel decisions by the New Jersey Supreme Court in the township of Mount Laurel, which had excluded zoning for multifamily housing. And the New Jersey Supreme Court found this exclusionary zoning to be a violation of equal access for renter families in the community and required that Mount Laurel provide for rental housing, which was a substantial, might say, revolutionary change in the zoning of that town. That really, it kicked off 40 years of practice nationally. Some of the first jurisdictions to adopt inclusionary housing were in Columbia, Maryland, and throughout California. And today, hundreds, by some count, more than 600 jurisdictions have some form of mandatory inclusionary housing obligation. That is, conditioning the development of market rate housing on a set aside of a certain number, percentage of units as affordable at a specified income target. The trends in the last real estate cycle, dating from the mortgage crash and the last recession, which were deeply felt here and throughout the country, is for jurisdictions by the scores. We actually don't have a census. It may be by the hundreds to strengthen existing inclusionary provisions, either by increasing the percent unit set aside, deepening the income targeting, and or increasing the in-lieu fee payment option. And we're seeing this as a repeating trend in our practice. As the commissioner noted, we've advised about 60 jurisdictions over the last 25 years in this process. We've learned a couple of key lessons through a wide variety of real estate markets, jurisdictions, and geographies. One of the first lessons is that the cost of producing housing is not related to its price. And I think this is a very key finding and a fundamental principle of real estate price, which is a function of supply and demand. And so what we often hear in response to a jurisdiction's efforts to adopt either impact fees, which is this is not, or a police power action such as zoning code reform through inclusionary housing, is that developers would pass through the cost of compliance to the consumer, to the tenant, or to the home buyer. And if you think about this for a moment, this assertion, it would suggest that the developers of housing are not already charging market price for rent or sale price. In other words, that they're somehow voluntarily discounting because otherwise the price would not be able to absorb an increase. And so,
just before you go on, could I ask a clarifying question? By and large, it would seem that the developer is not going to own the project long term. So are you going to address that? Because I don't understand why it's not the developer who's going to be managing the apartment and passing on the fee for the tenant.
Well, many developers do own long-term. If we're talking about institutional asset class, sort of class A properties for multifamily housing, rental housing, developers may own for a period of 10 years. They may sell interests in the project to investors and lenders, take collateral interest in the project. So I would say yes, for investment-grade properties, often developers do own, especially in rental housing. Market rate rental housing. A second key lesson after almost three decades of practice here is there is an economic effect of imposing a zoning condition, as there is in any zoning condition that the city would adopt. And this effect really gets worked out in the price and value of land. And so if you are a landowner, your value of that land for market rate development fluctuates as it does in response to other variables in real estate economics, the price of money, the cost of construction, the cost of materials. The methodology that we've employed to quantify the change in land value is called residual land value, which is really established as the standard for determining the effect of real estate values on development, whether we're talking about office buildings, hotels, or residential housing. When we talk about the effect on residual land value, it's important to place that in the context of land markets. And so it's been fascinating for us to see here in Portland that post-recession, land prices, while the city of Portland has done nothing to change its zoning code, have increased more than 100% when you hold zoning constant. And this is actually not a surprise to us. We've seen this in many high-cost markets throughout the United States. And so what this suggests is that the fluctuation in land price is actually highly volatile. It's highly sensitive to developers' bets or risk-taking on the near-term value of housing and what they're willing to pay for land. And so when that price is locked in a sale contract, it's a fixed cost for the developer. When it's optioned, it's a price that could be varied based on the terms of the contract. For landowners, they don't have the luxury of changing their price for the land, right? They own the land already. So there will be an effect on land value for landowners. The finding that we have seen in our practice over many years is that when a jurisdiction calibrates its land effects at about 25% of residual land value, that falls well within the standard trading range of land over real estate cycles, which we've said in this city has been more than 100%.
Can you clarify what that means to calibrate your land effect to 25%?
What we mean by that, Commissioner, is the research which NORA conducted in collaboration with the staff and the panel of experts was to quantify the effect of alternative set-aside obligations at alternative income targets on residual land value by zoning. So we look both in the downtown and in the mixed-use zones across Portland. And we did that under a common set of assumptions about the cost of developing those types of housing in Portland today. Does that help? Yeah. I think that guidepost, maybe 25% more or less of shifts in residual land value effects, if I may, is something that you might use as a guidepost in thinking about the range of land trading prices, which have exceeded, I mean, in some cases have been 160% in the last 3 years. The last point I would make is that we're not aware of a jurisdiction that has undertaken this effort with intent to entirely offset that price effect. Real estate development is a risky business. Land prices we've established are highly volatile. Just like you have a general plan, just like you have a series of system development charges, those are done really in your police powers to promote the general welfare that you're tasked to provide for as a municipality. So as long as this is done within realistic bounds, as the legal standards establish, you're operating well within the norm of other communities. And with that, I turn this over to Nora for her particular comments in Portland.
Thank you, Commissioners. Okay. As Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, we did an economic analysis of inclusionary housing options for the city of Portland. And this was done through a highly transparent public process with a panel of experts that you'll hear from later today. And we worked very closely with this panel and with our sub-consultant, Eco Northwest, to develop both development prototypes and economic assumptions for the costs of building and revenues and costs of operating those prototypes, reflecting the current Portland market. And as I mentioned, we went through several iterations of each of the prototypes and the assumptions with input and feedback from the panel of experts. And these resulted in what we feel are relatively conservative assumptions. They incorporated recent increases in construction costs, partly have been affected by the high production level that you've seen in Portland in the last few years, which has resulted in competition for contractors, particularly for steel and concrete high-rise construction, which has bid up prices beyond what they might otherwise have been. And as I mentioned, this is kind of associated with a massive increase in production in the past few years. We believe that the program recommendations that the Housing Bureau is presenting are feasible based on our analysis. For prototypes with above a 5.0 FAR or above, the incentives really offset the costs. And this is something, as David had mentioned, that we don't often see in other cities where the offsets substantially or fully offset the cost of the program compliance. For prototypes below the 5 FAR, especially in the mixed-use zones, we do see some reduction in land value, I think up to about 25%. In some cases, the optional 10% at 60%.
10% of units at 60% AMI actually generated better land values for the mixed-use zones than the mandatory proposed 20% at 80%, which would provide an incentive for 60% units to be developed. But when we compare that kind of 25% reduction in light of the land value fluctuations that David has mentioned, we see that looking at actual assessor's data from 2010 to 2016 on transaction sales of land by zoning category and by FAR, we find that in the central city zones, we've seen increases, depending on the FAR, from about 26% to 150% over that six-year time period in land value increases. That's kind of from the beginning to the end of the period. And within that, we see a lot of volatility where the actual total swings in land value, when you include the up and down, so even if it's trending up, there are up and downs. We've seen swings of 49% to 160% in those land values. In the mixed-use zones, over the same time period, we've seen increases in land values of land prices of 24% to 123%. And again, within that, even larger swings of 40 to 140%. So we believe that the possible reduction in land values resulting from the program, where they may occur, are but a fraction of the actual fluctuation that's naturally seen in the land market without the city doing this type of program or any other type of action. Thank you.
Now we'll turn it over to Kurt Krieger and Matt Schabold to walk through the proposal.
I just have one question.
Yeah,
so in the 60 jurisdictions in which you've worked, have any of them triggered a legal challenge?
Yes.
And can you generalize about the attack, the legal attack on what you're recommending?
So we advised the City of San Jose on the adoption of a citywide mandatory inclusionary housing program, which the mayor and council approved. The California Building Industry Association, CBIA, challenged the San Jose ordinance as a taking under the takings provision of the U.S. Constitution. The appellate court in California upheld the BIA. I'm sorry, the Superior Court upheld the BIA challenge. The appellate court reversed the challenge. DRA was retained as an expert witness in this litigation. And then, importantly, the California Supreme Court published a ruling upholding the San Jose ordinance as a strongly endorsed function of municipal police power to promote the general welfare, A. B, to assert that this is not a taking. C, to assert that this is not an exaction, but this functions rather than under the nexus standards of Nolan and Dolan, which govern impact fees. This operates under long-established, more than a century, of police power authority of municipalities. And then later this year, the U.S. Supreme Court, the BIA challenged the California Supreme Court finding to the U.S. Court, which upheld the California decision. And I've shared that decision with Commissioner Saltzman's office and the staff. So the San Jose case, as published by the California Supreme Court, is the strongest endorsement to date that we are aware of in the legal record, upholding the right of municipalities to adopt this provision.
What was the vote on the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, is that my gotcha question?
I don't.
This was your project. I thought you'd remember every minute of it.
I don't know. It was. I don't know. I think it's in the published opinion, which I've provided staff.
So I have a question, which actually maybe should be postponed to later and tell me if that's true. But, I mean, there's a significant difference in the incentives for the central city and base FAR 5 or above and mixed-use zones. In particular, the proposal for mixed-use zones is 10-year property tax exemption in affordable units. Under Central City, it's 10-year property tax exemption on all units for sites with base FAR 5.0 and above. So that seems like it's a much greater subsidy per unit in high rises. Economically, isn't there an argument that if it costs so much more to subsidize development in the high rises, you should just say for high rises they pay a fee in lieu, which could be used to build more units at a lower cost somewhere else?
Well, let me answer the policy part of your question and defer to Nora the sort of implicit quantitative part of your question, Commissioner. As a matter of policy, we generally prefer the provision of units to the payment of a fee. Some of our clients prohibit the option of paying a fee. Cambridge, Massachusetts does not have that option at all. The reason is severalfold. For some, inclusionary housing, and this dates back to the Mount Laurel decision I mentioned, really a policy aimed at promoting economic integration and preventing economic segregation caused by residential development patterns. Now, that was the whole foundation of the Mount Laurel case. For others, it's perhaps more practical. We want to see the affordable units come online as soon as possible. And the payment of a fee, by definition, defers the development of the affordable units and makes it somewhat challenging. You have a very capable department here, and Portland, frankly, has been very good about amassing resources to promote affordable housing in the midst of your crisis. All that said, you have to find sites, you have to ramp up leverage financing from other financing sources, you have to find third-party developers. We often see in-lieu fee money not hitting the ground in units until 3 to 5 years after development.
I was just going to add that, I guess building on what David said, we think that the incentives do provide a strong incentive for developers to provide the unit on site. We understand there is an in-lieu fee option that will be used by some developers if those incentives, you know, are not considered adequate or relative to the payment of the in-lieu fee.
One thing that I hope we can hear is what the cost per unit of the subsidy we can expect to be in various contexts. Because, we've been criticized for spending too much per unit on affordable housing in general. People have said that $200,000 to $250,000 of public investment in one unit just seems like a lot. If the subsidy for the over 5 FAR central city units is $700,000 per unit, then that strikes me as a problem. Even if it's $320,000 per unit, that strikes me as a problem. So I hope you'll walk us through what the actual cost is expected to be.
Could I just add one more comment? You began your presentation talking about opportunity and equity. You talked about economic integration as a value driving why we want to invest in affordable homes throughout the community. Recognizing that the future is going to be hard to predict, that we're likely to see some changes that are hard to predict, leave it at that. Can't you also make an argument that investing downtown in slightly higher cost units is part of our obligation to affirmatively further fair housing?
If the cornerstone of that is opportunity for people across the community.
Well, I think you're asking my personal opinion. Yes, I think that economic integration is a key value to the policy of inclusionary housing. And then inclusionary housing is one, albeit a very important one, tool to be used in an overall housing strategy. And I referred to Portland having a number of tools by grace of the voters and this council, frankly. So hats off to you. I think there comes a point, and I think it might be a colloquy between the two of you, at least these two comments, where the best value for producing units lies. So if somehow we can get greater production off-site and that can be managed, that might be worth doing. New York City wrestles with this question of economic integration in high-rise buildings by arguing about what floor the affordable units are on, which, personally, I think is missing the point. I think the provision of the unit is more important. Other people disagree. Obviously, people have strongly held views about that. So I do think that the economic integration argument is really important. I think another key issue, which you didn't mention in your question, is commute times, proximity of jobs, housing, and transit, and making the community more viable for the families and individuals who call Portland their home, their place of work, and where they send their kids to school. So I think all of that in terms of productivity and lost commute time for families is another important consideration.
And just, I mean, to talk about, I mean, and I agree that inclusion is an important value, and I do not want to have all of the poor people or lower-income people exiled to the far reaches of the city. However, at a certain point, it seems like we might face a choice between what is more, what would you rather have? One person in the high-rise and one person homeless, or two people somewhere not in the high-rise? And I think that we need to, you know what those trade-offs are.
So now we'll turn it over to Kurt and Matt to walk us through the actual recommendations.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and good morning, everyone. Kurt Krieger, Portland Housing Bureau, and with me, Matt Scheibold, the Policy and Equity Manager for the Portland Housing Bureau. First, to paraphrase Charles Dickens, these are both the best of times and the worst of times. Developers and developer overhead and profit are reaching uncharted territory. People are making more money now than they ever dreamed they could in this marketplace. Portland has been elevated to top tier status by institutional investors and by international capital looking for profits and reliable returns. So in that regard, it's the best of times to consider looking at the total bundle of costs, as David mentioned, with respect to housing, and consider ways in which to infuse our public policy goals as a cost of doing business in Portland. And conversely, this is the worst of times for renters and would-be first-time homebuyers. As Commissioner Novick mentioned, people are economically displaced to the farther reaches of the city, if they can afford the city at all. We'll release in the next week the State of Housing 2016 edition. It's a inexorable march, if you will, a diaspora, an economic diaspora, which is forcing many working families and low-wage earners into out of the city entirely. So for them, relief can come not too soon. And when you look at the history of inclusionary housing in places, Mount Laurel, certainly Montgomery County, Maryland, Fairfax, Virginia, that have had this in place for over 25 years, there is a reliable stock of permanently affordable housing connected with private developers by tapping the hydraulics of the private market and to ensure that they continue to do good business in the city of Portland. So our work these last 8 months has been to find that sweet spot, if you will, between balancing the hard and soft costs of doing business in Portland and also then extracting public value from developers as they choose to do work here. It's the art of inclusionary housing and making sure that we get that right. And I do want to commend the panel of experts and the vision of the legislature to give us these tools. It's important that you know that we retained David Rosen and Associates prior to the session even being convened, because we had full intention of going forward with a linkage fee, which we felt was perfectly permissible under Oregon statutes. When the legislature did enact Senate Bill 1533, we amended the scope of work to include this inclusionary housing work. So we've been working on this all year. And just to remind people who might be watching this for the first time at home, Senate Bill 1533 basically created a series of mileposts in how we can devise such a program. It can only be mandatory for households at 80% of the area median income and above. It can apply to rental and for sale buildings with 20 or more units. It stipulates that local governments choosing to enact inclusionary housing policies provide incentives for affordable units, such as SDC, system development charge, or fee waivers, financing and tax exemptions, and it stipulates that a fee in lieu option be provided. Those are the statutory sort of milestones that we had to operate within. The other thing I'd like to recognize is the panel of experts was instrumental in NORA's work as we sorted through the economics of land use and development fundamentals in Portland. Eco Northwest devised a series of typologies. Those typologies included everything from three-story lightweight frame construction to high-rise construction. And NORA, working with the panel of experts, modeled the residual land values in each of the urban zones within Portland. So this has been evaluated at great length. We are sparing you that detail, but that detail is available should you be interested in a deep dive into the residual land values by zone. I do want to recognize that Sarah Zahn, Dyke Dame, Dr. Lisa Bates, Dr. Ronald Lear, Amanda Saul, Vivian Satterfield, Maggie Talmadge, Eric Kress, Greg Goodman, Kira Kador, and Nolan Reinhardt were all actively involved as members of the panels of experts. Some are economists, some are planners, many are advocates, and many are developers. Their interests are divergent, so they were never asked to take a group position because, frankly, getting to a consensus with such a diverse group would have diluted the effect. But they did provide to Commissioner Salzman their best thinking about ways in which to harness the private development sector without stifling growth or development or causing unintended consequences such as growth in the wrong place, growth of too many units under 20 units in size, or larger, a failure to actually achieve our 2035 comprehensive plan goals of 123,000 new housing units. The other thing I'd like to say is that in the Planning and Sustainability Commission's review, there was a great deal of attention given to the rate of inclusion and the offsets. And we made it clear at the time that it's really the City Council's domain to consider the offsets. So the Commission did have a unanimous due pass recommendation to support the rate of inclusion as proposed with some caveats and concerns. And we've responded in writing to those caveats and concerns, which needs to be part of this record and in preparation for your public hearing. But in listening carefully to what the Planning and Sustainability Commission had to say, Commissioner Salzman is advancing some revisions, and those revisions will be filed today. And they will be available for public review prior to the public hearing next Thursday. So the policy framework that we enacted at the very outset last winter as we undertook this effort included several important policy assumptions. First, and this is slide 5 of the handout, we wanted to ensure that this was a citywide program which calibrated the inclusion rates by different geographies. We needed to recognize the realities on the ground, differences between neighborhood costs and central city costs. Secondly, while we were able to set a mandatory program at 80% of AMI, we wanted to calibrate the incentives to more robustly encourage 60% units. This was very much an open conversation with legislative leaders during session. And that was most of our existing programs were focused to households under 60% of AMI. Your allocation of tax increment financing to housing is limited, generally, to households under 60% of AMI. Your prior agreement to award SDC, or system development charge waivers, is limited to households under 60%. And we did not want to change the policy direction of council. We wanted to reinforce the policy direction of council.
So I want to just say, hear that again, that we're only waiving SDCs on the affordable units, not the entire project.
That is correct.
Thank you.
And the current practice is exemplified in projects like The Yard, where there are 57 affordable units at The Yard. We are receiving 60% AMI units for 60 years. What thing this does change by aligning all of our resources, and we're actually getting more public value. You'll see that we're getting 99 years of affordability instead of 60 in the case of the SDC waivers or 20 years in case of the property tax exemptions. The third point I'd like to say about the policy assumptions that we received from Commissioner Salzman at the very outset of this offer is that we very much wanted to prioritize units on-site over the receipt of a fee in lieu. I've administered programs elsewhere, and my experience is, as David says, if I receive a fee, I have to accumulate multiple fees for multiple units in order to create a fundable project. I, as a bureau director, then have to procure a site, often in competition with a private developer, paying market plus whatever price premium is attached at the time to that site. And it is often a lag of 3 to 5 years. So we are more inclined to try to tap the hydraulics of the private market, cause the units to be developed where they are most desirable, where the private investment dollars are invested in opportunity-rich areas, so that we are not compelled to look at accumulating the fee and spending it elsewhere.
And Kurt, the fee in lieu would go into the HIF?
The fee in lieu would actually be isolated in its own inclusionary offset fund. We think it's important because the Housing Investment Fund currently receives program income from the sale of other real estate assets, and we don't want to commingle those funds. So this would be isolated in its own inclusionary housing fund. That way the council auditor and any private auditor can track the receipt of those funds and the expenditure of those funds separately from other housing investments.
But as a practical matter, you could take the money, you have two pots of money that you can,
it could be
you
layered.
You can layer to be working on projects as you're accumulating the resources.
Very true.
And can you tell me what would be the allowable uses of the fund?
Well, there needs to be a nexus between the payment of the funds and the use of the funds. the basic idea being that a private developer that is paying a fee in lieu needs to recognize that that was for the intended purpose of household generally benefiting low and moderate income households. David, would you like to?
Just one clarification. I wouldn't characterize the fee in lieu, neither do the courts, as a nexus fee. So the payment of this fee is not subject to legal standards of nexus or reasonable relationship.
I didn't hear the answer to my question. What would be the allowable uses of the fund?
We currently only directly invest Housing Bureau resources for households under 60% of AMI. I don't see a particular reason why we would fund any households above 80% of AMI, but there may be a mixed income community where that would apply.
Asking in a different way.
Commissioner, in terms of the parameters of the fund, it would be identical to the Housing Investment Fund. The fund was actually created already when council chose to adopt the construction excise tax, and the income parameters and the programming parameters are identical to the Housing Investment Fund. We just wanted to split the resources for accounting purposes in separate city funds.
When you come for the public hearing, I think that would be very helpful to have that noted on, mm-hmm. Have it in writing or on the PowerPoint. I think that's going to be a question that lots of people are going to be asking. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Continuing on with the policy assumptions, we wanted to apply an inclusionary housing requirement on buildings, every building over 20 units in size that was eligible, and that we wanted inclusionary units to be comparable in terms of the configuration, bedroom size, and composition of the other units in the building. In other words, we didn't want the affordable units to be all clustered into one particular portion of the building or economically isolated.
Speaking of size, one concern that I've heard voiced, I forget by who, frankly, in the past few weeks, is that right now the market is producing one-bedroom and studio apartments. So if we get our units within the existing market and existing projects, then we're not going to have units that are usable for families. So at some point I'd like to hear some discussion of that issue.
I think it's perfectly appropriate, and some of the work that I did when I was still with OTAC for the Seattle City Council was to calibrate their property tax exemption to encourage and incentivize more family-sized units. That is a hybrid that we can experiment with as needed. What we can't really compel developers to build something that they're not building already anyway. And I think that's a practical reality. But if we're putting money into units over and above the inclusion, I think you can buy handicapped accessibility in proportions greater than the state minimum requirements, you can also buy larger units as a portion of your public investment in the project.
Okay, but that would envision a greater public investment than we're anticipating the subsidy here. I don't want to keep on coming back to this, but it seems one argument for having a viable fee in lieu is that you could use that money to make direct investments in larger units.
Mm-hmm. And last, I would like to go ahead, David.
I was going to say what a number of our client jurisdictions have done with regard to this concern, which is a frequent concern, that the bedroom count configuration of market-provided units is often smaller and less suitable for family-sized households, is compliance options are either skewed to incent the provision of larger bedroom count affordable units within the project, meaning there might be a lower unit count for larger bedroom mix, or your percent set aside might be counted by bedrooms, not by units, or might be counted by square footage, not by bedrooms or units. All of the developers are highly creative people. There are just some sort of simple engineering standards about construction and multifamily housing where you want to stack bedrooms and kitchens and the plumbing and the power fixtures. So observing that design requirement up front in, say, discussions with the Housing Bureau, we have seen some flexibility. So it need not require more subsidy, far from it. It could be achieved through some administrative flexibility in discussions between the developer applicant and the Bureau.
Yeah, I would love to see some thoughts on how this could look, you know, the options like set aside being by bedroom rather than by unit.
That's actually quite common. And I may have mentioned in my intro, Cambridge, a recent client of ours, requires that for buildings of more than 50,000 square feet, 20% of the affordable units be three-bedroom units. It's not even negotiable. It's just, and so knowing developers crave certainty, and so knowing that developers will design from an engineering perspective and cost efficiencies, as I mentioned, accordingly.
The last public value I'd like to underscore that is embedded in this program design is permanent affordability. As a city, we've been incentivizing developers through property tax exemptions and fee waivers, but we've been getting temporary affordability. And I don't think any one of us wants to revisit the wave of mark-to-market units that could happen in the next 10 to 20 years as properties that we've currently are motivating through property tax incentives reach the end of their regulatory agreement. So embedded in all of our assumptions has been that we are going to buy longer-term affordability so that it becomes part of the social infrastructure of the city, not a temporary fix to our current housing needs.
As a practical matter, what happens if a building is demolished at 50 years or is destroyed in some natural disaster or whatever? How does the covenant, our practice has been a 10-year affordability on the tax abatements, 60 years. Now we're in the 100-year range. What happens if that exceeds the lifespan of the building?
Well, of course, these are recorded deeds on the property, and it run with the land. The buildings themselves, as you say, may have a finite economic life, although everything that's being built in the central city is being built for 100-year economic life and will likely last longer than that. If we have a regulatory lien on the property, we'll have to talk about it with the building owner and developer at the time that the building is replaced as to what is the remaining residual worth of that inclusion and what is the council policy at that moment in time going forward, because you may well have recalibrated, rechanged the program. I would expect that they would apply to whatever new policy exists, deducting whatever current obligation they have remaining. And there may be a cash out of that value at that moment in time. They have an insurance settlement. There could be a reconciliation of the value at that point in time.
The owner, let's say there's a fire, property's destroyed, there's an insurance settlement, the owner takes the settlement and wants nothing more to do with property. Under this covenant, a recorded regulatory restriction on the land, not the building, the sale of the land would be conditioned on either replacement housing at the targeted income levels originally regulated, or there may be some negotiation provision on the sale of the land. But replacement of a structure on the land, and let's say a hotel is then replaced, then there would need to be some provision made for a payment, right?
So would then the burden be on the realtor who's doing the sale to highlight that this has got something?
Well, that's a great question. We have seen lenders ignore recorded regulatory covenants and wreak havoc with asset management practices on a portfolio of assisted housing over time. And the city, in our opinion, is what we spend a lot of time on asset management, is well advised to be watchful year over year over year for compliance. It's not through malfeasance. It's often through just either not understanding or not looking. I'm not ascribing motive here. But to protect this asset long term requires some staff resources to watch the kitchen, as it were.
So I don't know if you're going to get into that later, because I am interested in the administrative cost moving forward. And then it does get back to my question at the beginning of, you know, supposing the developer, whoever it might be, is not in the business of holding rental property, how does the breaks that the developer got in building it get passed on to the next owner? Or do they have to, would the next owner have to charge higher than median for that, for less, higher for the non-affordable units in order to be able to continue to turn a property?
Any sale or transfer of the building under the covenants, which I think we're all contemplating here and have all worked with over decades of practice, would require any new owner to comply with the affordability restrictions on the restricted units.
Right, but then they didn't, the new owner, developer's long gone. How then does the new owner factor in that they've got a certain number of units that they can get less from?
The value of the adjusting their price on what they pay for the project.
The value of the building is predicated on those obligations. And they're fully informed through the title report as to what those obligations are.
Currently, the Housing Bureau is responsible for reporting to Council every year on compliance with all of our regulatory agreements. And we have a regular exercise of kicking people off programs if they're not. And that's actually become so routine, we do it mostly on consent. Once upon a time, it had a lot more drama. I assume, as part of our safeguard here, that you will be reviewing this annually and reporting to Council if there are any projects that are not in compliance with our regulatory agreements as a further hedge about, you know, future changes.
That is correct. We'll do it in the context of the state of housing, so you'll see it once a year. Just to move along, since we have some invited testimony, slide 7 describes what Commissioner Salzman's revised recommendation to you will be, and that is that we're going to stagger the implementation of this program in mixed-use zones by initially lowering the rate of inclusion and lowering the fee in lieu. This is very much a recognition of that gap that Nora described, the residual land value gap, being left somewhat uncovered in the mixed-use zones, and trying to be as responsive as possible to the Planning and Sustainability Commission's concern, which they elucidated in writing.
Before you go on with this, you've skipped slides 5 and 6 about parking. So could you please go into that? And the cost of, and whether it's just the affordable units that don't have to have parking, or whether you may be...
I think we're going to cover parking later on page 10, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, slide 10. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Matthew to click through the actual construct. And then we have a panel of 4 individuals, including 2 people from Planning and Sustainability and 2 people from the panel of experts.
And I'm lost. What page are you on in there?
Well, Matthew is migrating now to
slide 8,
which is page 4.
So given the concerns that were raised by the panel of experts and the Planning and Sustainability Commission, Commissioner Salzman and the Housing Bureau have modified the recommendation, particularly in the mixed-use zones. And so I'd like to take some time and just go through the current proposal as is for the city overall, but also touch on the mixed-use zones and the changes that have occurred. And then I know we've got our invited testimony, and I know we've got a lot of questions and discussion. So moving to slide 9, while the original recommendation was an inclusion rate of 20% of units at 80% of the area median income, and 10% of the units at 60% of the area median income, given the drop in residual land value, as mentioned by Nora and Kurt, the commissioner and the Housing Bureau have modified the recommendation to incorporate a two-year phase-in. And so for... Page five,
slide 9.
Mm-hmm. So the initial rate between now and the end of 2018 would be a 15% inclusion rate at 80% AMI and a 8% inclusion rate at 60% AMI. And then in 2019, the inclusion rate would increase to the original recommendation of 20% of units at 80% AMI and 10% of units at 60% AMI. Moving to slide 10, the incentives would be the density bonus, so any height and FAR bonus that were conceived under the mixed-use zones project. We haven't modified those recommendations. There is a lengthy community conversation with many individuals that had interest in the neighborhoods with respect to scale of buildings, and so we're not proposing to modify that density bonus, but to utilize it with the inclusionary housing program. There would be a 10-year property tax exemption on the affordable units, a construction excise tax exemption on the affordable units, a waiver of parking requirements when units are provided on-site, or if the units are provided off-site, which, as a reminder, would need to be provided within a half-mile radius. And then SDC waivers would be granted on the affordable units at 60% AMI and below.
So, again, my question is, waiving parking for all the units or just for the affordable units?
For the building, if they had units, the entire building, if they had units on site.
And could you just give me an estimate of how much does a 25-unit building cost?
A 25-unit building cost to build?
Yeah, what would be the developer's cost to build
it? Well, I can reference it in our prototypes, and let me get that number to you.
It's relating to parking, because if the number we've been using in the other discussions is 50,000 for a parking spot.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a 20-unit building, that's $1 million.
Yes.
So how does that relate to the overall cost of the building?
So in our modeling, we modeled in the mixed-use zones four different parking scenarios. One, which would be an on-grade parking scenario. One, which is a tuck-under. One that is a underground. And one that was, Nora, what was the fourth? Podium. In the scenario, the cost increases as you go underground. And what we're estimating, and we'll see this when we move to feasibility for the mixed-use zones, we're going to talk through the feasibility, is that in the CM2 zone, which is the zone we're presenting here today to model feasibility, the value of exempting the parking requirement is about $30 per square foot of site area. And our models are modeled on a 20,000 square foot lot. And so you're talking about in the realm of $500,000 of exempted cost if you exempt the parking requirements for a typical CM2 development.
So on the, when do you expect to have a rough sketch of what the incentive would look like based on the council action last week, proposing to eliminate the parking minimum for and link it to IZ?
In terms of the feasibility?
Just how that's incorporated. What we thought we would do is provide a
council memorandum at the end of today's meeting prior to the public hearing on the 8th, which will ball all this together so that you'll have a litany of different points supported by the research. So that'll be essentially an executive memorandum that David will transmit to the council.
Okay, and what I'll be looking for, Kurt, is in the context of what we decided last week, my hope is that that it takes a lot of pressure off the other incentives to have the parking minimum be linked to IZ, and because we've been told that it'll effectively apply to almost every to every project in the context of what we did with the amendment last week. So our hope is that it takes the pressure off the other subsidies that would otherwise have to be used. But I'd like to get a sense of how you view that.
Yeah.
But
we'll have it on the record.
I mean, I thought that you're already assuming waiver of all parking requirements in your proposal here.
So, yes, to the question, it is.
Yes, we have already assumed the waiver of parking requirements in the modified proposal when units are provided on-site or off-site in close proximity, and we're going to talk through the feasibility. So what the impact of that is on feasibility, and we worked on estimating those numbers with staff from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and if that's a direction council wants to move in, we are already working on the accompanying code that would be necessary to put it before council at the hearing and a possible vote.
On the issue of property tax exemptions, at some point are you going to talk about whether the exemptions you're talking about would run up against the, I think it's a $3 million a year cap we have mm-hmm. on affordable housing property tax exemptions that we'd need to get the cooperation of the county, et cetera, in order to move up?
Mm-hmm. So when we get to the central city, I'll touch on the cap. Tax exemption cap issues.
By the way, just because I've been through this battle, you actually have to get the concurrence of the county commission and the county assessor. The county assessor has independent standing to approve or disapprove any tax abatement, which makes it a little more complicated.
Presumably, we have to get the school districts to agree too, right?
Yep. Yes, they have to agree also, school district.
So turning to slide 11, what you'll see there is the modified fee and lieu schedule on a per gross square foot basis for the mixed use zones. And again, this is taking into consideration the idea of phasing in the fee and lieu. Just very quickly, the original fee and lieu was calculated based on, Commissioner Novick, to your point, the amount of revenue that would be needed for the city to acquire land and produce the unit offsite. So that if a developer was choosing to not have affordable units in their building, the fee schedule was established so that the city could build the same number of units, albeit with the time delay that both David and Kurt mentioned.
And Kurt, how does that translate into the building that we'd have to build? Yeah.
The subsidy that we modeled this on is, it takes the city on average about $100,000 of subsidy per affordable unit to acquire the land and build the unit itself. And so depending on the number of affordable units in the building, the fee per gross square foot is roughly equivalent to $100,000 per affordable unit they would have otherwise provided on site.
But that's usually much less than we usually have to pay to build affordable units.
Correct. We modeled it based on the average city subsidy. If we wanted to model it based on the true cost, the fee would be about three times as much.
And why did you choose not to do that?
We chose to do that because we were looking at the price to the city of Portland itself in order to finance the development and construction of affordable units off-site that often will use bank financing or tax credits to leverage the city subsidy in order to produce the unit.
We could actually built at 100,000.
Correct.
Assuming that low-income housing tax credits and tax-exempt bonds are used in the replacement housing capital stack, this would essentially supplant those other resources as we currently do.
I haven't seen in any of the projects that have come through that we've been able to build for $100,000.
We're underwriting projects at that level today now. And the NOFA that was released this April included eight new projects that met that standard.
I think it might be worthwhile when we have the public hearing to do a 10-minute primer on the various tools we use to build affordable housing. Because in this current debate between cost and value, and I have found this debate relatively disheartening because it's so fact-free, what happens is people cherry-pick numbers and use that against us. And the fact is that if you assume the whole package of subsidies, then you get a bigger number. If you're looking at the city's contribution versus equity contributions and other tax credits and whatever, it's a different picture. That gets lost in sometimes in this debate. I think it's also lost on some of the narrative we see in the press. And so I think going back to sort of, you know, how we finance and what our toolkit is and what is our investment versus the leverage of other tools. Now, it's true, technically speaking, that you add up all the public subsidies from every source, and that does come from a taxpayer. But I think what gets lost is that our contribution is often a much smaller percentage, and that, I think, is what we should be debating. What is our contribution, not necessarily the merits of a federal program that requires that